Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we open our show with the latest updates on COVID-19, including a surge in cases and hospitalizations locally and new medications now available in our region. The identities of the four people killed aboard an air ambulance that crashed in El Cajon in late December are now available, and we'll tell you about these remarkable individuals on today's show. Our newsmaker interviews today are with Barry Jantz and Elizabeth Urquhart from Stop Cottonwood Sand Mine, a neighborhood group that's organized to oppose the proposed sand mine along the Sweetwater River on the Cottonwood Golf Course site. Now, the county has released a draft EIR that community members say is flawed for failing to acknowledge major potential impacts on water, wildlife, quality of life for residents, and more. There are two public meetings coming up in January for the public to weigh in before the February 14th deadline for comments, and we'll have details on how you can make your voice heard on today's show. And we'll have a report from Public News Service on Medi-Cal fees that may soon increase for low-income Californians, as well as a story on a new program to help refugee students attend college. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Marie Johnson with a health report on the latest COVID-19 updates. San Diego County is experiencing a major surge in COVID-19 cases. On December 30th, county health officials reported 5,976 new cases, up sharply from 3,600 cases just one day earlier. As of Sunday, January 2nd, 628 patients with COVID were hospitalized in San Diego County, the second highest number in the state. Of those, 124 were in intensive care units. The COVID case rate is three times higher among unvaccinated people than vaccinated individuals, according to the county's Health and Human Services Department. Even more troubling, the hospitalization rate is four times higher for unvaccinated persons, and the death rate is seven times higher among unvaccinated patients than those who were fully vaccinated. With the fast-spreading Omicron variant now in our region, the county urges patients to get vaccinated and get a booster shot. Anyone exposed is also advised to get tested, though long lines at some test locations have made testing access challenging. Only those with severe symptoms should go to hospitals for testing, while those with mild COVID symptoms should call their doctors for advice. In light of the increase in cases and hospitalizations and the spread of the Omicron variant, the California Department of Public Health has implemented a new statewide mask mandate. The mandate requires that Californians age 2 and older wear a facial covering in all public indoor spaces through at least January 15th. With many industries such as airlines and healthcare facing staffing shortages, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control recently revised isolation guidelines. If you've been exposed to COVID-19 but don't have symptoms, you only have to isolate for 5 days instead of 10, but you should wear a well-fitting mask for an additional 5 days when around other people if you are unvaccinated or haven't had a booster shot. If you've had a booster shot in addition to the vaccine, you don't have to quarantine at all if you don't have symptoms, but you are asked to wear a mask for 10 days after exposure when around others. If you do have symptoms, isolate until a negative test confirms that you don't have COVID. Anyone exposed to COVID should get tested 5 days after exposure. There is some good news amid the ongoing pandemic. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has issued emergency use authorization for two new oral antiviral medications, the first COVID-19 oral medications for home use. Both are available in limited quantities at some local pharmacies, with more shipments expected soon. The new COVID medications are Pfizer's Paxlovid and Merck's Molnupiravir. A prescription from a medical provider is required for either drug. Both are administered over the course of several days in pill form, and treatment should begin within days after symptoms appear. Both will be available to patients with mild to moderate COVID-19 symptoms who are at risk of progressive to severe corona disease, including hospitalization or death. However, molnupiravir is not recommended for those under age 18 or for pregnant women. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says, "The FDA's emergency use authorization of these new oral antivirals comes at a critical point in the pandemic as we see an increase in cases and a rapid spread of the Omicron variant." But she adds, "News of the arrival of these drugs does not mean that we can let our guard down. We need to continue to mask up, especially in crowded indoor spaces, and I urge anyone who has not gotten vaccinated or is overdue for their booster shot to get vaccinated as soon as possible," Dr. Wooten concludes.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
An FAA investigation continues into the cause of a deadly Learjet crash December 27th near Pepper Drive and Magnolia in El Cajon's Bostonia neighborhood. The crash killed all four people aboard the air ambulance plane, which was owned by AeroMedevac. The Learjet was flying from Orange County to Gillespie Field when it crashed. The victims have been identified as two nurses and two pilots. There were no fatalities on the ground. Lori Gentz, a nurse from Escondido, was the local union president of the International Association of EMTs and Paramedics. Tina Ward, also a nurse, was the wife of retired Oceanside Fire Department Deputy Chief Joe Ward. A scholarship created in her memory to train future first responders has raised over $44,000. Captain Douglas Grande had been flying with the medical transport company since May 2019. Julian Bugage was a certified flight instructor who had transported many patients and organs around the country for life-saving procedures. AeroMedevac voiced great sadness at the loss of lives. On its Facebook page, the company posted, "The loss of our friends has left us in an indescribable void. To both us and their families, they are unsung heroes dedicating their lives for others in need throughout our community." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery, host of the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, my very special guests are Barry Jantz and Elizabeth Burkhart, leaders in the Stop Cottonwood Sand Mine, a citizens organization that is opposed to the proposed sand mining project along the Sweetwater River at the Cottonwood Golf Course site. Barry and Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
Well, now, for those who are not familiar with this project, can you start by describing the scope of exactly what's proposed? You know, how many acres would be mined, how many tons of sand, and over what time period?
The proposal involves mining 251 acres on a property that is 280 acres. So it really will be the full length of both golf courses, where the sand mining will occur, and it will occur in four different phases. So it'll be about 20 to 30 acres at a time that they're mining, and then they'll move to the next phase until they complete it in 10 to 12 years. And then the proposal is to reclaim the property and sort of try to put it back together again.
Okay. But for 10 years, at least, things would be disrupted. Now, the draft environmental impact report has just been released by the County of San Diego, and the public has until February 14th at 4 p.m. to submit their comments. There are also two public meetings coming up. Can one of you please provide details on how the review process works and how and where the public can weigh in?
Sure. So this is a draft environmental impact report. And the purpose of the environmental impact report is to really inform the public about what the developer plans to do to mitigate environmental impacts as a result of the project. And so there's a 60-day process for the public to respond to this draft. And that's what we're in right now. So the February 14th date you mentioned, I believe, is the end of the 60 days. There are a couple of meetings, public meetings. People can also send a comment anytime in writing now without attending a public meeting, but we'd certainly encourage people to be involved in the public meetings. And one of them is in person, and that is Wednesday, January 12th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at Hillsdale Middle School. And that's 1301 Brabham Street in El Cajon. We're also going to give our contact information. So if anybody needs, you know, details or wants an email, you know, describing this information, we can do that. But that's the in-person meeting. And then there's an online phone-in public meeting or teleconference. And that's Wednesday, January 19th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. And there is a web link for that, which we can provide. There's also a phone number, but I think, you know, the best thing is if we give our contact information, right, if people want to reach out to us so we can provide these details. And we can also provide the details on if people really can't attend a public meeting. Again, we encourage it, but if for some reason people can't, we'd certainly encourage people to comment on the project and what they view as the impacts of the project.
And what is your website for your organization where people can find all of those links and all of that information, which we will also post in an article on our site at eastcountymagazine.org?
It's Stop Cottonwood Sand Mine. So all of that, stopcottonwoodsandmine.org.
Yeah, that's an easy one to remember, Barry.
That's the email address. That's the website. And then the email is info@stopcottonwoodsandmine.org.
Okay, very good. And the links there for how people can file comments with the county are all listed. Now, the developer is New West Investments, which is owned by Michael Schlesinger, who has, I understand, a history of converting golf courses into housing. This time he's going for a sand mine instead. But the developer would argue that the sand is needed for road building and other construction projects so that, you know, builders in our area or the county do not need to import sand for other from other regions. Now, interestingly, in San Diego County, developers actually pay for their own environmental impact reports, and they even choose who will write the report. It's a process that critics have said on past projects can tend to lead to a minimizing of some serious environmental impacts. So it's really important, folks, for the public to take a good close look at these documents and point out anything that might be inaccurate or have been omitted. Now, understandably, it's a big, complex document, and I know neither of you have had time to read all of it and you know, fully assess it all, but can each of you please share at least a few of your biggest concerns about the Cottonwood Sand Mining Project? Elizabeth, we'll start with you.
Sure. I have had an opportunity to go through the entire document, but not every single appendix. There really are thousands of pages that are involved in an environmental impact report. And I do understand that the professionals that are hired to write the reports, the required reports, are professionals, of course, and they have to be approved by the county. And the person who writes the environmental impact report and talks about the reports really can pick and choose the pieces that they want out of the reports. So that's the part we really have to take a look at, because it's important for us to go to those exact reports and see if it really matches with what the person, the author of the environmental impact report, is saying. It's important for us to reach out to experts that we know in the community and across San Diego to assist us with responding to the EIR. You know, some of us have a little experience in doing this, but not, you know, in all of the different parts. So that's why it's so crucial. I took a deep dive into the aesthetic part of the EIR, and that is the one part that the report has come out and said there are going to be significant impacts to the aesthetics, you know, what everything is going to look like to the public.
Yeah, astoundingly, that was the only thing that they said was a significant, unmitigatable impact, right? Not impact on wildlife in the adjacent wildlife preserve, water quality, air quality, you know, impacts on residents, traffic, potentially wildfire issues. None of that. The only thing they found to be unmitigatable was the view, what you would be looking at. What do you think about that? I know you've called this a flawed project, but tell us why.
Well, I think it is flawed because that is the only area that they're saying is that they can't mitigate is the aesthetics. And yet I believe, and many of us believe that there are many, and you listed them very well in terms of the biological impact, cultural, the noise is going to be huge, never mind the traffic. And there are pieces that they say they can mitigate, but they can't mitigate all of it. And even the pieces that they say they can mitigate, if you look really deeply into it, you know, they don't point out the proof of why they think, you know, something could be mitigated. For instance, the noise. We're in a valley and they're talking about putting up 8-foot, maybe 12-foot barriers that are going to, you know, keep the sound from residences that are as close as 400 feet. But our residents live, you know, on all different elevations around the valley and the Sweetwater River. So yeah. It makes sense that, you know, an 8-foot barrier is going to do that. And it's going to move as they move the sand mining across, you know, their property. It's not going to mitigate any of the hauling trucks. And we're going to have a hauling truck going by one every 2 minutes.
Wow. Every 2 minutes for 10 years, basically. What, 5 days a week, 6 days a week?
Monday through Friday. And they're going to be doing that from, I believe, 9 to 3:30 every day. And yep. They're going to start at 7 a.m. in terms of actually processing the sand. So we're going to hear all, and they're using very large equipment on this project.
Barry, let's hear from you. What are a couple of your major concerns as someone who lives not far from here?
Yeah. So, I've dug into the land use and planning portions of the document. And you know, this all goes back to some requirements within the county of San Diego, and they come under the county general plan. The Valle de Oro, this is within the Valle de Oro Community Planning Group, so it's in the Valle de Oro plan, and also the county zoning ordinance. And all of those documents refer to protection against incompatible land uses, and that projects must be compatible with the character of unincorporated communities. And the Valle de Oro plan really gets into that because in this case, the community plan for Valle de Oro wants to retain a unique balance of urban, semi-rural, agriculture, and open space land uses. New development within the community is to conserve natural resources and topography and provide a pleasant, safe environment for community residents. Okay, so those are the underlying themes within the county requirements. So as I look at the land use and planning pieces of this document, what I really see is the whoever wrote the report very minimally says, okay, that's why there's no significant impacts because we meet all these requirements. Why? Because we're going to have a major use permit for a time and then we're going to put everything back and it's going to be more beautiful than it was before. So what it doesn't take into account here is that we're not talking about an 18-month project or even a 2-year project. We're really talking about 10 years of mining, 2 years of reclamation, and then there's even an added time element for the reclamation for growth to come back to where it was, mm-hmm. And they're putting 5 to 7 years on that. So if this was 18 months or 2 years, I think you could, doing the minimal work they have, maybe make some arguments that you're compatible because it's only a minor impact to folks over a short time is what they'd argue. But this is for minimal of 10 years, 2 years after that, and then even some additional time. That's without getting into any delay. And that's why I think the document is flawed. It doesn't get into the significance of the overall time. If someone has a child going into kindergarten at the beginning of this, when it's done, that child's going to be away at college.
Yeah, and there are schools and businesses near this also, right? Tell us a little bit about the neighborhood and what's immediately nearby.
Well, yes, Elementary School is 1/4 mile from the property. It's very close. And adjacent to that is a very large park that a lot of residents use and sports teams use on weekends. And so that's very, very close in terms of daily, you know, Monday through Friday, daily processing of sand that has, you know, truly the ability to cause valley fever, asthma, other respiratory diseases. And it'll be very sensitive to people who already are experiencing those kinds of, you know, concerns and diseases. They'll be more susceptible to having problems with the silica in the sand.
And I think illustrating the absurdity of this EIR, that really I think is one of the sites the least impacts of just about anything I've ever read for any major project. They even say it wouldn't impact recreation when they're eliminating a golf course. And I might add,
that's a definite part of the land use element, is that it is zoned for recreation use. And so, again, you know, the purpose of a major use permit is without having to do a rezone, to say, hey, we're going to cause a major use other than what is typically allowed in this area. But is that really for 10 or 12 years? I don't think that's makes it compatible, going back to those county documents, compatible with the existing land uses. And Elizabeth mentioned there's homes, you know, within 400 feet. These homes are adjacent. Many of these homes are directly adjacent to the project site. They have, in other words, they have a back fence on the project site.
Well, and it's fine to talk about restoring in 10 years, but you know, if the noise and pollution and so forth scares away or kills off threatened and endangered species, it might not be so easy to bring those back.
They believe they're going to mitigate that by, if they're going to be within 400 or 500 feet of nesting, you know, endangered birds, then they'll, you know, move back and try to, you know, make sure they're not close to the extent feasible. And that's a phrase that's used a great deal in the document, to the extent feasible, which really doesn't tell us anything.
No. And
they're going to do whatever the heck they want, you know, without regard to any of the biological impact.
Well, I think it's worth mentioning too that the open space at the golf course and those large ponds that they've had out there were long used by wildlife. I know I've had readers send me photos of deer on the, you know, grazing on the grass there, and the groundskeepers would tell me they would regularly see mountain lions in the evening out there. So now that water source is going away and I haven't seen anything about replacing it. What about fire danger? Do you believe that the project could increase either the danger of fires or make it more difficult for existing residents to evacuate due to the increased traffic?
So Elizabeth, I don't know if you even, you know, because we're trying to wade through this document at this point. We've got different people taking different pieces. I mean, I looked at the part I read, which is a land use planning, does get into some traffic and just, you know, there's an additional turn lane going to be placed at the existing entrance, and then there's going to be another turn area installed along Willow Glen where one isn't now. Those will have turn lanes, but with the trucks coming in and out, I don't think there's any, you know, that's a busy road as it is. I don't think there's any guarantee that turn lanes, you know, are going to be a full mitigation of the traffic concerns resulting from these trucks, you know, running regularly, you know, between 9 and 3 or whatever it is, you know, Monday through Friday. There can be traffic, especially as we approach the Steel Canyon Bridge and people trying to turn onto that and get off of that, especially when schools going in and out, things like that, there's traffic already. So as soon as you have an emergency, or you've got a fire or someone with any kind of heart there needs to be paramedics responding, virus, whatever it is,
it can be slowed.
Definitely potential for delays.
Right. And we know if an ambulance doesn't get there within minutes, if someone is having a heart attack or isn't breathing, it can literally be a life or death issue. So every minute counts.
In addition to the 176 trips that large trucks are going to make, so 88 round trips, large trucks per day, they're going to have up to 18 large hauling trucks just lined up on Willow Glen Drive. You know, they're going to create this kind of, as Barry already mentioned, a right of way into their parking lot. But these trucks need to be lined up on the road, ready for, you know, picking up the sand and then hauling it down back down Willow Glen. So it's not just the trucks going back and forth, but they're going to be on the road even. And so I think that certainly will cause a problem in terms of the regular traffic. And, you know, interestingly, the thing they talk about traffic is right now, Willow Glen and Steel Canyon are very busy. So with us adding these number of trips, even with large trucks, it really won't impact it much, which I think is really quite.
Yeah. I mean, one way of really looking at it, and you maybe you really need to know the area, but these trucks, as they leave the site, both at the existing entrance, which is kind of the entrance of the golf course now, and then the added entrance they're going to put on Willow Glen, these trucks are going to be making left-hand turns out of the site. Do you know what a big truck is like turning out of a site? It doesn't go quickly.
Slow.
It's not like when you step on your gas because you got to get across. These are, you know, so this is going to halt traffic in both directions several times an hour. And so I just don't see how that can really make it with, by the traffic review they've done.
Yeah. How can you possibly say that it has no significant impact? You know, it's astounding. Elizabeth, you have said that these shortcomings should be addressed. That you've called it an incomplete draft environmental impact report, and that it should be reissued to the public to review. In other words, basically, they need to do it over again before a major use permit could be issued.
Right. I mean, it's only fair to all of us and to the public to truly understand, you know, the comprehensiveness of this project and the true impacts, you know, not just to us, but to our roads and to, you know, our plants and our animals. They really have glossed over it, and they haven't, they're not telling us the truth, you know, what really can happen in terms of sand mines. There isn't anywhere that we asked the developer at, they had done a presentation at the Valle d'Or Community Planning Group when we were first talking about this in 2018.
Yeah.
And they were asked, can you tell us and show us another community where there is a similar sand mine, a similar industrial, you know, project like this in the middle of a developed residential area with businesses and homes and schools, senior centers, so that we can understand, you know, how did they do it?
Good
and
question.
What were the benefits for that community and how did it turn out? And they couldn't name one at all in California.
Wow.
That says something. It's inappropriate. And Barry, you've always said this, that yes, we understand the need for sand. You know, we need it to make concrete, but this is an inappropriate location. It isn't compatible with the uses that are currently occurring in Rancho San Diego. And that's clearly it. We need to find another place.
And you know, to make it clear, I mean, for anybody who may be wondering, you know, this isn't the kind of sand you just go get at the beach or at the desert, right? Let's acknowledge that. This is a different kind of sand that is used in aggregate construction. I don't think there's any question it's needed. But just because something's needed doesn't mean it's appropriate to mine it anywhere. Okay. I mean, and that's where we have to say this is, it's just inappropriate and incompatible with the existing neighborhoods, which it's surrounded by businesses, schools, residents. And that's really why we're opposed to this.
So what kind of experts is your organization, Stop Cottonwood Sand Mine, hiring to research in this draft EIR? And what other help, if any, do you need other experts you're still looking for, in case we've got a listener or viewer out there?
I'm going to let Elizabeth. Elizabeth's probably very versed right now in where we have people reviewing the document, where we still have some needs. But I just want to make sure hiring should be a very loose term. This is all volunteers right now. We're not, this is all volunteers. Okay. We're doing this voluntarily. So hiring is people who are, you know, going to get
correct.
A cup of coffee from me at some point, maybe. But go ahead, Elizabeth.
No, you said that well. I mean, down the road, if necessary, we may have to do that. we may have to fundraise and hire experts. But fortunately, right now, we know people that are experts, and people are sort of coming out of the woodwork and offering their assistance. And we do have the Sierra Club has experts that are working on review. The Audubon Society is reviewing in depth the document. So they'll be looking at the biological aspects. The Sierra Club will be looking at the environmental aspects. We have a hydrologist engineer who's looking at the water pieces. Mm-hmm. We also have a couple of folks who are in construction project management, specifically around environmental uses. And so they have been taking a look at it around the construction pieces. There's so many different aspects to this.
Do you have a wildlife biologist? You mentioned the Audubon, but for the non-birds, the mammals and the fish and other things.
Right. We do have two biologists who are looking at the review, but that we can use more, because I think people who look at it and understand, you know, what to piece out and what, you know, makes sense and what doesn't make sense is going to be the most helpful. So we definitely could use more help. Where we're kind of lacking right now is we really don't have a lot of folks focused on the cultural resources.
Yeah, Native American and archaeological.
Yes. So that is an area, you know, we've got some feelers out, but that hasn't come through yet. So that's definitely an area of need.
You know, the tribes, I went along on a demonstration of this a few years ago. They have access to dog teams. They're actually trained to detect ancient remains. In other words, my understanding is they won't alert on, say, a recent body, but if something's been there for thousands of years, these dogs can actually detect it. And the demonstration I went along on, they were absolutely accurate in finding some that were in the path of Sunrise Power Link, and the result was SDG&E had to go overhead for a stretch instead of underground for a stretch because of the you know, the resources that were found there.
Miriam, at least one of the tribes, I'll leave the name out right now, mm-hmm. because I don't want to put anybody on record in case, you know, it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
But we are going back to them, because one of the tribes did indicate early on they were going to be very engaged on this. And most recently, they did say they hope to respond in writing with mm-hmm. their concerns by the deadline. But I am asking them if they can't do it, if at least they could suggest someone who might be able to help with those cultural resources piece. As Elizabeth said, that's something we do need.
Okay.
You know, interestingly, in the report, the environmental impact report so far, the author is saying that we are going to create an agreement with the tribe or tribes, and we will come up with a plan of how we'll ensure that, you know, we're properly treating anything that we find. But they don't get into any of the detail about what that agreement is, or, you know, has anyone even looked at such an agreement and you know, weighed in. And so that's something I am finding, you know, incomplete. They should have already done that. You know?
Yeah. And there's such room for abuse. I recall in Akatia when they were building the wind farm, even though the tribes had brought these dogs out, they alerted, said there's ancient remains here. It went to the coroner's office, but he didn't get around to testing it until after the project was built and said, oh yeah, these were remains thousands of years old and they'd been just destroyed, you know? So you're right. The devil's always in the details. Mm-hmm. It really does bring the county's whole process, I think, under scrutiny too. I will say that I have on past major projects heard from some wildlife experts, biologists, and at least one cultural resource consultant who were hired by these companies. And they told me they were told to whitewash things. Several of them said they were threatened with being blackballed and not getting work in this field again, at least in this area, if they didn't say essentially what the developer wanted them to say and ignoring certain things that might be project stoppers. So it's very troubling. I'm curious whether either of you want to weigh in on this process of having developers choose who will write the EIR and even hiring and paying for that.
I don't know that I can get into, you know, any firsthand knowledge of that or anything like that. I would mm-hmm. like Certainly, we're talking about a developer consultant relationship there. I mean, I'd like to think, you know, I'd like to think that that the county is doing its diligence in its process, and certainly the scoping letter that the county released, you know, a couple years ago now, 2019, more than a couple years ago, did do a very adequate job of saying here's what the developer is going to have to do. And so, you know, just because this EIR is out and we believe it clearly is unacceptable EIR, you know, doesn't mean the county's necessarily going to buy into it. What it means is the county wants to hear from us now in the public about why it's unacceptable. Right. And so that's the important thing to me. And I'm going to rely on my hope that once all those comments are put out there and all those letters received, that the county is going to agree and say, yeah, we also reject this EIR as inadequate.
Yeah, we should make clear that the next step in the process, once an EIR is finalized, it would have to be approved by the county planning board, the planners, and then ultimately by the county board of supervisors. So there are still several levels of the review process to go through here.
Just to sort of piggyback on what Barry is saying, how crucial and important it is for everyone to weigh in and to send in their comments, it really does create an administrative record that is important, because the developer then must respond to all of those valid concerns and comments. They must.
True.
And then if the project for some reason is approved, we also have on record our concerns. And so, you know, there's the ability to, you know, create lawsuits at that point.
Okay. So ultimately the courts could weigh in as well.
I just want to add to that too, because you described the process well, Miriam. You know, the EIR itself, even if approved, that doesn't approve the project. The EIR just is a piece of the overall project approval. And the EIR does, you know, gets into environmental impacts. It doesn't get into other things we have concerned about, such as impact on property value, things like that. That is ultimately potentially a political decision by the Board of Supervisors, you know, down the road, not just the EIR itself. So we're going to stay on.
Yeah. Now, for those who may have tuned in late and missed the beginning, folks, you have until February 14th to submit public comments on the Cottonwood Sand Mining Project. And there are two public hearings coming up. To recap, those are an in-person meeting on Wednesday, January 12th at 7 p.m. at Hillsdale Middle School. So that's in what, Rancho San Diego area?
Yes.
And then there's a virtual meeting for those who prefer to weigh in online on Wednesday, January 19th from 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. And you can find links for how to email comments or details on those public meetings, if you didn't catch all of that, at eastcountymagazine.org. Just put in Cottonwood Sandmine and you'll find it. And also at the stopcottonwoodsandmine.org.
Both work.
Okay. Website.
And Miriam, I'll just say it one more time. If people can, you know, have trouble with any of that, they can just email also at info@stopcottonwoodsandmine.org with any questions they may have. Of course, I know I'm putting it on Elizabeth to have to answer those emails, but we do want to answer people's questions.
Yeah. And do you have any tips if people want to submit comments, what points they should keep in mind to maximize the effectiveness of those comments? In other words, as you pointed out, talking about something like property values may not affect an environmental impact report. What are the points people should keep in mind?
Yeah, I mean, we've mentioned some of them. And I think, you know, everybody in their mind, you know, knows how, depending on where they live, how this project's going to impact them. So if they just focus on those things that they think are going to have an impact on them, whether it's aesthetics or traffic or noise or air pollution, emergency response, that's a really good one that we talked about today. Elizabeth, anything? I mean, wildlife, obviously, that's a huge one. You know, people, so it goes back to me. It's, again, it's the compatibility of the existing land uses and the impact to those who live in the area. So any impacts people see, it's okay to weigh in on those. I don't want to miss something you may have had.
I would agree that it doesn't have to be just what's listed in the EIR. It could be other things that we haven't thought about that people are concerned about, and they should definitely share those comments with the county.
Yeah, good.
And by the way, just because I said the EIR doesn't get into things like property values, I mean, if people have concerns about their property values and their quality of life in their mm-hmm. existing neighborhoods and the impact of them, you can mention those things.
Yeah, those are certainly things planners and supervisors can weigh in on, even if it has nothing to do with the environment. So good point.
Just to let you know, and your listeners, that the Valle de Oro Community Planning Group will also hold a public meeting. That's going to happen on Tuesday, February 1st.
Oh, okay.
At 7 p.m. And it's not absolutely confirmed, but most likely at Hillsdale Middle School, the same place as the previous county meeting. And there may be a presentation by the developer at that meeting. There's been a subcommittee, which I'm also a part of, that has been focused on providing input to the Valle de Oro Community Planning Group about the project so that they can make a recommendation to the county about whether to approve or not approve, or approved with, you know, contingencies.
Very good. And we should note that the California Environmental Quality Act, better known as CEQA, actually requires that projects be compatible with the county's general plan, as well as with community plans, such as the Valle de Oro plan. So that's a very important step in the process there. Is there anything else that either of you would like the public to know that we haven't already touched on?
The only thing I noted is we were talking about, you know, how we believe this report is inadequate, and you know, but we've also talked about the complexity of the report. And so I want to make sure people who, you know, may pull up the report. I don't know that everybody, you know, is going to pull up the report and actually dig into it. But, you know, those that may see the complexity and think, well, this is really thorough and this is really detailed, right? Well, because of the length. But, you know, so to the untrained eye, you know, maybe, oh, well, this is a really thorough and detailed report. Well, that doesn't mean all of that content in there really addresses the issues that need to be addressed. And that's why we believe it's inadequate, because we've dug into it enough, even though there's way more reading to do, to know that it's just glossing over and minimally addressing the issues to be able to get to project approval.
Right.
Without getting into real mitigation.
It's important to note that while one can argue whether mitigation can truly, you know, adequately minimize harmful effects of any project, if an EIR finds that a project doesn't create any serious impacts, then they're not even going to be mitigated in any way. And again, for those who tuned in late, some of the things, let me read them, that this project was found to, the draft EIR says, would have no significant impacts from this project include air quality, energy, greenhouse gas emissions, hazardous materials, hydrology and water quality, land use and planning, and transportation and traffic, also agriculture, forestry resources, geology and soils, mineral resources, population and housing, public services, recreation, utilities and service systems, and wildfires. And I don't think we have to be a rocket scientist to realize that a sand mining project on a river upstream from a federal wildlife preserve and close to many homes probably is going to have at least some impact on things like wildlife and water quality and air quality and transportation. So it's really important for everybody to dig in, look at this, or at least write to the planning folks and or come to the hearings and let them know how this is going to affect you, what your concerns are. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Urquhart and Barry Jantz from the Stop Cottonwood Sand Mine Group. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to join us here today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
California's lower-income families could have to start paying hundreds or even thousands of dollars a year for Medi-Cal health insurance premiums, payments that have been waived during the pandemic. Once the public health emergency subsides, the pandemic waiver will expire. So, groups that advocate for kids and families are asking Governor Gavin Newsom to eliminate the premiums in his next budget proposal, which is due by January 10th. Fatima Clark with Children Now says the return of premiums could cause struggling families to go without coverage.
With no end in sight to this public health crisis, we should not be creating a disincentive to families to get care. These are households that have borne the brunt of the pandemic, yet are still struggling to make ends meet and put food on the table.
Only three other states require low-income families on their state health insurance programs to pay monthly premiums. Almost 160,000 pregnant people and families with children received the waivers from March to September of this year. Opponents of a permanent waiver cite budget concerns. Clark estimates it would cost the state about $8 million a year. Recently, more than 450 organizations signed a letter asking the governor to waive Medi-Cal premiums. Clark says the move would increase access to care for up to 700,000 Californians.
The health and financial well-being of many low-income families hangs in the balance. If lawmakers are serious about promoting economic security for families and communities, then eliminating Medi-Cal premiums should be a no-brainer in the next year.
Last year, the state allocated $20 million to be able to offer $0 premiums on some health plans in covered California. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
By next fall, refugee students may be able to apply to attend American colleges and universities. The State Department says it plans to pilot a new category for refugee admissions called a P4. P4 status would allow a group or institution to sponsor a refugee, and a university sponsorship program would allow that person to study in the U.S. and then apply for permanent residency. Laura Wagner is with the Initiative on U.S. Education Pathways for Refugee Students, part of the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration. Wagner says the current foreign student visa program requires students to leave after they graduate.
Right now, we are getting the best and the brightest of the world, and then we're saying, thanks, now you have to go back to your home country, whereas this would provide an opportunity for them to stay and continue to use and share those talents with their new community in the U.S.
The Alliance recently published a report calling on the State Department to implement a P4 category this spring. Community colleges and universities, including UC Davis, would step up to offer free tuition. Philanthropic groups would cover other costs, and the State Department would aid in resettlement. Wagner says refugees deserve a shot at a brighter future in the U.S., a country founded by immigrants.
Less than 1% of refugees worldwide are able to be resettled. We have only 5% of refugees accessing higher ed.
Advocates of the pilot program say it could initially be limited to 30 students who would apply next fall and start their college classes in 2024. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Next up, we're going to play one of our Best of East County episodes, taking you on the road to the Julian Fiddle Competition from a couple of years back. Each year, the town of Julian comes alive with the sounds of music, fiddle music, along with banjos, guitars, mandolins, and mountain dulcimers at the annual Julian Fiddle and Pickin Contest. Recently, we're seeing a revival of interest in the art of fiddling and, more broadly, a renaissance in traditional music both regionally and nationally. Avery Ellisman is the district representative from the California State Old Time Fiddlers Association, which started 40 years ago. Locally, there are now around 60 members on a mission to enhance appreciation for and involvement in old-time fiddling. He says there's been a huge bump in sales of acoustic instruments nationally, according to the National Association of Music Manufacturers. And locally, two major nationally known musical instrument manufacturers, Taylor Guitar and Deering Banjo, are both adding staff here in East County. Baby boomers have the money and the time to rediscover the joys of just fiddling around, a pastime that evokes bygone days when life was simpler and the pace of living was slower, with time to listen, learn, and make some music of your own. Ellisman says of fiddling, this is the music of the people, adding, one person sits with and teaches another. Fiddling is most prevalent in rural areas, also a popular pastime to while away time during inclement weather. It's what people did for entertainment, kids, long before the advent of radio, TV, or the internet. Ellisman says, I consider music to be one of the highest forms of human celebration, a celebration of life. Fiddle music is infectious in a very positive way. The world needs more of that. Though played on the same instrument as a violin, he adds, fiddle music calls you to dance. Julian's old-time fiddle and pickin contest has its roots in a Julian banjo and fiddle competition that started over 60 years ago. For many years, it was run by the Julian Lions Club, but as the club's membership aged, interest in hosting competitions waned. The focus shifted to entertainment, and eventually the event dwindled. Ellisman runs the Julian Family Fiddle Camp each spring to teach fiddling skills to the next generation. So he asked the Lions to partner with his group and the State Old-Time Fiddlers Association, but he says the Lions declined. So Ellisman turned to the community instead, asking the local Chamber of Commerce and local merchants to support a new and revitalized competition. The community agreed, and the competition has grown ever since. It's now a 2-day event, encouraging visitors to spend the night and help boost Julian's local economy. Ellisman calls Julian the jewel of East County, noting that the event draws people from across the West and as far away as Alaska. The first modern-day Julian Fiddle and Pickin contest was held in 2014. Fiddling refers to bowed instruments, while picking is for unbowed instruments such as the guitar, mandolin, banjo, and mountain dulcimer. Ellisman notes proudly, we have kids from age 6 up to age 86, and they're playing together. It's a wonderful way to bridge the generations. Before, Julian's events were not traditional fiddle contests, but now they are. Each competitor must perform 3 elements, a hoedown, a waltz, and a piece of the musician's choice, such as a jig, a polka, or something else. Competitors can compete in age-based categories or in an open competition that any age can enter. The open competition is considered the premier event, with bragging rights for winners who beat all comers. At the 2016 competition, Ellisman's 16-year-old daughter, Shira Ellisman, competed for the first time in the open competition category. Early in the day, youngsters competed, and then in the afternoon, the open picking competition was held, followed by the open fiddling division. Announcer Dwight Warden explained that the history of fiddling goes back to the 1700s in America. Thomas Jefferson was an avid fiddler. Fiddling gained popularity again in the 1900s, thanks to Henry Ford, who liked fiddling so much he had fiddle competitions in all of his dealerships. But then fiddling events shifted to hokum and showfests, with people playing fiddles behind their heads or beating on instruments with broom straws, Warden recalls. More recently, the pendulum has shifted back to traditional fiddling styles that popularized the genre to begin with. In the 1950s, a major competition in Idaho put the focus back on musicianship, and the modern fiddle competition was born. All 3 pieces must be played within just 4 minutes, and no hokum is allowed. Shira Ellisman opened up the fiddling competition playing Sally Johnson for her hoedown entry, followed by Morning Star Waltz and Don't Let Your Gal Go Down. And here's a little bit of what this talented fiddler sounded like. The local teenager's teacher is Luke Price, a graduate of the Berklee School of Music, who is also a 2-time winner of the National Fiddle Championship. After Shira was finished, the announcer exclaimed, "She's got a future ahead of her!" The competition was stiff, with many other talented performers. After the contest, 3 of the fiddle judges also performed, Matthew Hartz and Luke Price, both multiple National Fiddle Competition winners, and Mabel Vogt from Idaho. Hartz told the crowd, "I'm excited to be here and come before a group that's so supportive. For us to carry this music and art form forward, we need your support," he added, as some in the crowd offered up donations or purchased CDs. Hartz performed a festival waltz and Shuck in the Bush to a wildly enthusiastic crowd. Here's a little excerpt of this dual national champion's performance. Thank you. Finally, the long-awaited announcement of the award's winners came. First, the junior winners were announced, and then the open competitors. Tom Dillon of La Mesa, who plays with a bluegrass band, took first place in the open picking category. Then, the open fiddling winner was announced, and Shira Ellison claimed the top prize, beaming from ear to ear. Afterwards, her teacher, Luke Price, shared with us how he first got interested in music. "My dad started me on guitar and banjo at 3 years old," he said, in between signing autographs from his fans. "I started classical violin at age 8. It took me 2 years before I started exploring the fiddle genre." He said, adding, "It took me 2 years before I started exploring the fiddle genre." He's come a long way since then, passing along the skills and joy of old-time fiddling to a new generation, including Shira Ellison, as she commences her own musical journey. You can learn fiddling and picking skills locally by signing up through julianfiddlecamp.com and listen to the talented local and national competitors at the next Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest by visiting sandiegofiddler.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, this is Miriam Raftery. East County Magazine has won more than 125 major journalism awards, with reporting that's making a positive difference in our region. The East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ covers important topics such as fire protection, energy and environmental issues, stories from East County's Native American and Chaldean communities, rural issues, and helping local veterans. Please help keep the East County Magazine show on KNSJ by donating or making a sustaining monthly pledge at www.knsj.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.